So I think they gave you a little bit of a flavor of how we think about something, we find something, and it actually leads to a lot more fascinating questions that we didn't even know how to ask before we did our first measurements. And going from this first world and being alone and the telescope trying to figure out if the instrument actually broke or not, what is incredible as a backstory as well for the discovery of one of the first planets, the first planet around the Sun-like star, I would like to get us to the thousands of new worlds that Didier was already talking about. And we have found a lot of them from the ground, and he showed you the ones we have access to from the ground. The big ones, the hot ones, because we're looking through an atmosphere, and that atmosphere actually blurs our signal, because there's wind, there's different temperature, what I appreciate, because that's what we breathe. But it took a vision, and I think Bill will tell you a little bit about it took much more than just a vision to help us find these other worlds, these small worlds, and give us a first glimpse into the fascinating diversity that we're finding out there. And so with that, I want to introduce Bill Borucki, who is at NASA Ames, a space science at NASA Ames. He actually, in 62, designed the heat shields of the Apollo mission. So, you know, you don't have to just do extrasolar planets. You can also do some other things on the side. He was the VI, he is the VI of the Kepler spacecraft. And he just, among many, many, many awards, he just got the Henry Draper Medal of the National Academy of Science. And he will tell you what it takes to get such a visionary instrument that discovers thousands of new worlds out in the sky. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to talk a little bit about the ups and downs of the Kepler mission. The Kepler mission was designed to determine whether Earths are frequent in our galaxy, Earth's small planets in and near the habitable zone of many stars, and to give us statistical data that allows us to generate and design future missions that would go on to beyond what you've heard today and begin to look at the atmospheres of these planets. In some sense, determining the atmospheres, the molecules that are in those atmospheres, is a sort of step in our exploration of the galaxy. The Kepler mission is a space mission where we put a space telescope that orbits the Sun, not the Earth, and it looks at over 170,000 stars simultaneously, looking for planets that cross the star and block some light. By the blocking of that light, we can tell how big the planet is compared to the star, and when it repeats, we can tell the orbital period. From Kepler's third law, we can deduce how far the planet is from the star, and by looking at the properties of the star, we can tell how hot that planet might be. So I'm going to talk about not so much the discoveries, a little bit, but more about how you build such a mission. Because when you try to build a mission like that, what you find is you push very hard to get people to agree with you, to sponsor you, to build that mission. And then you find it rolls back, they won't accept it. You've got to try again and again and again until you make that mission succeed. So that's the part I will emphasize. What we see here is a timeline of the development of the mission. To the far left, in 1971, a person named Frank Rosenblatt wrote a paper about the fact you could use transit photometry, the darkening of the light by a planet, to find planets, including small planets. Unfortunately, shortly thereafter, he drowned in a boating accident, and nothing happened for about a dozen years. And in the early 80s, people were talking about how to find planets, and the thought was, we'll do astrometry. Not radio velocity, not transit photometry, but astrometry. We look at the position of the star change. I got very interested in that, and attended the conference, and one of the people, Dave Black, suggested, well, read this paper by Frank Rosenblatt and see what you think. I read the paper, I thought, gee, this is a grand idea. It ought to work just fine, except, of course, you had to build a photometer, something that measured the brightness of a star, 1,000 times better than anyone had ever built one before. Well, I had just worked on instrumentation for the Apollo mission, and that didn't bother me a bit. I thought, sure, that should be straightforward to do, provided you had enough photons, and you do. You need a big telescope. And so I got funded in 1983 with a small grant. In 1984, I wrote a paper saying, you could do some of this from the ground. You could look through the Earth's atmosphere with the blurring and the change in brightness and the dust and clouds and find Jupiter's, but you couldn't find Earth's. And so the thought was, let's go ahead and think about what else needs to be done. What else would limit you other than the photometer? And the answer was, in a paper with several of my colleagues, we talked about the fact that stars weren't, like people thought, either constant or variable. They, in fact, all would be variable at the very tiny variation level of a planet crossing a star. When Jupiter crosses a star, that's a 1% change you can do from the ground. Earth crosses a star, that's 80 parts per million. So your photometry has got to be like 10 parts per million. And so the ultimate limit is going to be by the star variations themselves. So I started talking about building photometers, trying photometers out at observatories, working with NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. And when I talked to people, the astronomers in particular, they said, you know, it's impossible. You can't possibly do that. Some of the older astronomers pointed out to me that God invented astronomers and photomultiplier tubes for each other. So I didn't get much sympathy, and in fact, here's a Space Science Review Board saying in principle it might work, but a clear identification by this technique appears unlikely. Some of the journals wouldn't even publish my papers because everyone had agreed it wouldn't work. There were people here, Dave Latham had talked to, mentioned that to headquarters, that we really should fund this, it might work. So there were people that supported it, and that was a huge help. In 1992, the first mission, the Discovery mission started. That was a series of missions put on by NASA that were intermediate in size. Not the little guys, not the flagship missions were $1 billion, but something that was in fact just right for Kepler. And so we proposed to it in 1992, and they said, well, there are no such detectors, we're not funded, not even gonna give money for a concept. And so we proposed every 2 years thereafter, and we were always rejected. And so I'm going to talk about those rejections and how we overcame them, because we learned from those rejections. It was sort of build a big proposal, have it thrown back at you, and then start over, but we learned each time. This was some data that we took at the Lick Observatory, where we were allowed to borrow a rejected CCD, where the light came in through the wrong end. And we were able to show that the CCD wasn't all that good, but if you measured its systematic errors and took them out, then it was excellent. And so we found that we could do, on average, 10 parts per million. And this experiment was just take a plate, drill a bunch of holes through it, put a light under it, have a CCD look at all these holes, and measure the light from one simulated star to another. So we could do the job. We proposed again, and one of the rejections came back and said, well, nobody has done automated photometry of thousands of stars simultaneously. And you have to do that. Because the chance the planet lines up with the star in your line of sight is of the order of 1%. So even if 100 stars have planets, you're only likely to see one. So you have to look at a large number of stars. And so they said, since nobody, the way you do photometry is you look at one star, measure its brightness, look at a comparison star over here, same brightness, same color, and compare the two. Now, the star you compared it with might be variable. So you've got a reference star next to it. And so you measure all night long across these stars, and you might get a dozen done. And then you take, after a few weeks of doing this, you take the paper chart recorder and a ruler, and you measure how the star brightness has changed. One star at a time, essentially. So they said, it can't, you know, nobody's ever shown it. Go build an observatory and show us it can be done. Now, it's not that very easy to build an observatory. Even the environmental impact statement is a pretty rough requirement. But NASA Ames was supportive. They said I could build an observatory with a credit card, as long as any purchase was less than $3,000. So we went to Lick Observatory. They had an old dome that didn't work anymore. And they said, well, you can use that. Just fix the dome because it doesn't rotate, it leaks, and there's all sorts of floors rotten and things like that. So we did. We managed to get a team of students together to rebuild that little dome. And here it is. The idea is we built some telescopes. We showed two telescopes here and here. They're small. You could hold them in your hands. And we automated that. We sent the signals back to Ames. We had a computer program. Natalie Battaglia was a good part of that. She'll talk next about that. But at first, it wasn't fully automated, and so you had to have an observer every night. And one of our observers was here, Spock. He actually wasn't a very welcome observer because he had rather weird tastes. Not only did he eat cookie crumbs, but he ate wires and cables and hoses. And so one day when he disappeared, I think everybody was rather relieved that he probably did a good favor for a coyote or a fox or something like that. In any case, we never found any planets with that, although we saw several thousand constantly, but we could see planetary transits. They were easy to see as long as we, somebody ahead of us, like Didier and others, had found a planet for us to look at. So we proved it could be done. We proposed again, and in this case, they said, well, that's great, you know, you've shown detectors work, you've shown you can do automated photometry, but no one has ever shown you can do 10 parts per million on a spacecraft in orbit, because it's not like a telescope bolted to the ground. You've got reaction wheels that hold the telescope pointing at the stars, and those reaction wheels aren't perfectly circular. So the telescope wobbles in space, and so the images are shifting back and forth across your detectors, and that's introducing a huge amount of noise. So they said, go build a facility and show us it can be done. Here's $500,000, which is, of course, exactly half of what you need to do the job, but we managed to talk Ames into giving us another $500,000 to build this facility. We used a lot of the machine shops in the San Francisco Bay Area. We had to do it very quickly, because every 2 years you had an opportunity to propose a mission. And if it took you too long, you missed that opportunity. Well, we managed to get it done. But one of the hardest things to do, you could build a little telescope, you build a plate with a lot of little holes drilled in it, a light lit it up like stars in a galaxy, and you could measure one relative to another. But what you had to show was that a tiny change in brightness could be detected at 80 parts per million for an Earth-sized transit. You say, well, that should be easy. Take a little piece of glass and slide it across one of your holes. That change is 4%. That's 400 times more crude than what we're talking about. You take a piece of glass and anti-reflection coat it, like your glasses or binoculars. That drops it to only 100 times too crude. And so we had to invent a new method. And luckily, one of the co-founders of the mission, Abe Koch, suggested this idea. Drill a bunch of holes for your stars like we do, put a wire across some of those holes, run a current through the wire, and it'll expand a few atoms in diameter, and that'll block some light from the hole. Didn't work at all. The holes were round. Of course, you drilled a round hole. You put a round wire there. And when the wire heated up, it bent out of the hole. So he was clever enough to say, well, drill square holes. And don't use round wires. Pound them flat, which is what we see here. And that worked like a charm. We were able to induce signals by Earth-sized planets, all sorts of planets, and show this system worked and worked well. So we proposed it again, and it was accepted. But it was, of course, accepted for competition with other missions. But we won that competition, and so did Dawn. Dawn was the other mission. Dawn is the mission, a Discovery class mission that's now a series making measurements. So in 2009, we launched in heliocentric orbit. I'll do that. A heliocentric orbit means a spacecraft orbits the sun. Its telescope looks at one group of stars 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. It doesn't blink. You don't want to miss transits. They only last for a few hours, and they might occur a few days apart or a few years apart. And so this was a great mission, and it's been extremely productive. We have found over 4,600 planets and planetary candidates. This is a summary of some of the things we've found to date. We have found some 800 Earth-sized planets, 1,200 planets bigger than Earth, super Earths, but possibly habitable, and then some 1,500 planets like Neptune, which are four times the size of that of Earth, but not many Jupiters. Jupiters are rather rare. They're easy to see, and small Earths are extremely hard to see, so it tells you certainly that Jupiters are much rarer than the small planets. But this sample distribution is very biased. It's very hard to find small planets, so we miss a lot of them. And we're talking about trying to find planets where we need at least three transits, so you measure the orbit twice, and you're sure you've got a planet and not something else. And so that's hard to get for planets that are in long period orbits, especially little ones. So one of our team members, Chris Burke, took our data and said, let's try to correct for some of these biases. Now, it's not perfect, but it's a very good first cut at it. And what we found was when you put in the little ones that you must have missed, what you find is you get to smaller and smaller planets, you get more and more planets. There are a lot more small ones, there are big ones. And what he did also was he looked at the stars that we are observing and said, some of those are too noisy. You couldn't find a small planet around them. You could find a big one. And so he corrected for that, and now he calculates how many planets per star on average. So on average, each star has a planet. So 50% of the stars are going to have planets the size of the Earth, another 25% the size of super Earth, and another 20% the size of twice the size of the Earth. So on average, every star in our galaxy has at least one planet. And you'll hear talks where that's maybe a minimum. And so that's amazing. 100 billion stars in our galaxy, 100 billion planets in our galaxy. So the mission has accomplished one of its major goals. Are Earths rare or common? They are very common. I'm going to mention a couple of interesting planet types that we found, the planet discoveries that we made. There are many, many more. Maybe Natalie will cover some of those or others. But this is a diagram, again, a log scale, like Didier was talking about. Here's our own solar system. The bigness of the symbol tells you the bigness of the planet, the size of the planet. Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And here are some groups of planets that are all inside the orbit of Mercury. Little groups of planets very, very close together, like Didier was talking about. But the group that's most interesting to me is this little group right here. Five planets about the size of the Earth here. But what's special about them is, and they're rocky planets, almost certainly, is they're around a star. They're orbiting a star that's 11 billion years old. The universe was made 13 and a half billion years ago. Our galaxy was still forming 11 billion years ago. So you had the first stars, the superstars explode, make material to make planets out of, and then new stars come along shortly, you know, during the formation of our galaxy that form these rocky planets. So the implication is, right from the start of the formation of our galaxy, we were forming planets that were rocky planets, planets that could very well be in a habitable zone. Imagine what life might be like, civilization might be like, on a planet that's a billion years ahead of us, or 6 billion years, even a million years ahead of us. The galaxy may be a very, very interesting place to explore. We also found some planets that are not in our planetary system. This is a planet in the habitable zone where liquid water could exist, but it's too big to be an Earth-sized planet. It's 2.4 times the size of the Earth. But it's too small to be a Neptune. Well, maybe it's a mini Neptune or a really super big Earth. But maybe theoreticians tell us we have here a water planet, a planet composed of mostly water or a heavy water surface with a small rocky core. And so we have an ocean planet. Imagine the life that might be in such an ocean compared to our own. Now, we don't know that there's life there. That will be a future for a future mission. And Kepler, of course, is generating the statistics we need to design for those future missions. But what we'd all like to do is find Earth size. We'd like to find the Earth twin. Planet exactly the size of the Earth, in the habitable zone, and around the star just like our Sun. We haven't quite found that yet, but we found close. Here is an example of a planet. This planet is essentially identical to the size of the Earth. It is in the habitable zone. The habitable zone around this star is quite a bit smaller. That is, the green zone is smaller than around our solar system. This is the solar system, and the two are to scale. But this planet, then, is in the habitable zone, but it's around a rather cool, small star. Does it have life? It's in the habitable zone. It's Earth's size. We don't know the answer to that. We don't even know if it has an atmosphere. It's going to take future missions to do that. So what have we learned from Kepler and from some of these other missions? What we have learned is that most stars have planets. We have learned that Earth-sized planets are very common. We have learned that they're a good fraction in the habitable zone. And that implies, when you put the numbers together, 100 billion stars, 10% planets like the Earth, 10% like the stars like the Sun, a billion planets in the habitable zone of stars like the Sun. So that immediately brings up the question, where are they? The Fermi paradox. SETI hasn't found any signal. We see no evidence of any civilization out there. And so this calls into question, brings to fore the questions like, are our assumptions correct? Is it that any time the situation is good for the start of life, it actually starts? Maybe that's extremely unlikely. Or maybe life does start and it evolves to the level of bacteria, like in the Cambrian period of our own planet. Or maybe it evolves to higher life, like dinosaurs, which ruled the Earth for tens of millions of years, but never built a technology civilization. They could never communicate star to star. Possible, of course, life does evolve to intelligent life, technology life, but that brings with it a catastrophe. We don't know the answer, but it's important for us to keep on looking, to keep pushing ahead, no matter what the objections and the difficulties. And so we are doing that. We have a mission today called K2 that's looking at the nearest stars to find the planets around them. So that's easier for us to further examine those. The mission called TESS will fly in 2017. It will do an even better job looking at all the stars. And ESA has a mission called Plato that will do another excellent job of finding those planets. But that's not enough. We have to build a mission way beyond that can look at those planets, block out the light from the star, look at the light from the planet, and get that spectra that Didier was talking about. And that spectra will tell us, does that planet have an atmosphere? Does it have water vapor and CO2, which is what you need for plant life? Maybe it has oxygen for higher life as well. And so that will be another big step in this exploration of our galaxy for life. But that's certainly not the end. One can imagine an even bigger telescope in space that could look at the hour-by-hour variation of the reflected light. You could see that the planet rotated. Did you see a lot of reflectivity from clouds or deserts or ice caps? Did you see the dips that an ocean would show as it goes by because it absorbs sunlight? Did you see the seasonal change in the color of the planet due to plant life? So there's a long ways to go in our exploration of our galaxy. Thank you.